Thank you for joining the Zesty Garden today. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we're pre-recorded, so I'm sorry you won't be able to call in, but you can leave your questions or comments, and we'll certainly get to things like that later, and that's at zestygarden@gmail.com, or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and leave your question or comment there. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, it's. I had other things come up, and therefore, you know, trying to do this live this week wasn't going to work out
it's
for us.
It's spring.
Yeah, you know, there's stuff that's
this
happening.
This is kind of your busy
state.
Time.
It's kind of, no, well, it's kind of like it last year. It all quickly popped on us, and the weather's kind of broke, and the snow is going away, and ground is drying out, and the farmers that I work with are starting to do some things, and I need to be at those events if I'm going to, you know, kind of do some of my other jobs here at the university. And so if we think about it from that perspective, many of us gardeners are also seeing things opening up in our lawns and in our flower beds. And I heard of people raking lawns out and getting flower beds cleaned up after the winter and all of the debris that kind of settles into them. And so, you know, if you had followed our advice last fall where we talked about, you know, prepare some beds to do some things, boy, there's a lot that we can start to do now in northern Utah. And if you're down in southern Utah and the temperatures are in the 70s every day, if you're not getting stuff out of your garden, then you are way, way behind, because it's certainly in St. George and Kanab and some of those areas much, much more conducive to gardening in February. And we need to really be thinking about starting at those times of the year.
Well, I'm at the point where I'm going to go to the south side of my house where the ground is soft, and I'm going to plant some peas. I just can't handle it anymore because I look in the back, and I've still got several inches of snow on the garden. So I can put some things on there to try to melt the snow down, but I'll just let nature take its course.
They'll come along in their due time, but, I mean, I was doing the same thing. I was looking at it over the weekend, and the snow on my side yard is now gone. The planter boxes that I have up right against the house, which are about 12 feet long. There's two of them, 12 feet long by about 2 feet wide, and they stand about 18 inches up off the ground. And we use them kind of as a seating area, so I've got that set up. But I also have flowers that I grow them in the summer, but I always plant spring vegetables. And so I was looking at my seed stocks in the refrigerator, and I've got leftover lettuce, I've got some mizunas, I've got some mustards, I've got some parsley, I've got radishes, I've got spinach. All of those things are going to go in, and I'm going to do that. It's Monday that we're recording this, and I'm doing that tonight. It's finally, the ground was a little wet on the weekend, otherwise I'd got to it, but I'm going to start turning it over, loosening it up a little bit here, and I'll be planting probably Tuesday night. I'll be putting a lot of those early crops out so that, you know, in a month I'll start seeing lettuce and things like that where maybe I'll have enough ready to start nibbling at the garden rather than, you know, getting the stuff that I get out of the grocery store.
Well, so tell me, Dan, when looking at things like onions, for instance, you can do sets, you can do plants, you can do from seed directly outside. What tends to work a little bit better, or does it depend on when you plant them?
Well, yeah, there's a couple things to consider. So let's talk about onions. I mean, I was conversing with some of our onion farmers either this week or early next week. Some of those guys will be in their fields prepping the soil to plant seed. So if you're really keen on onions for storage, for long-term storage, I've got onions in my garden from my garden area and from my research areas that have been stored from last October and are beautiful yet. Those work from seed, and they work fantastic. But you need to plant them here in northern Utah somewhere between the 1st of March and the end of March. That's when you want to put your seeds in. Now, normally we would say as soon as the garden surface is dry enough for you to rake off an area, that's when you want to plant those things like onions or spinach or peas.
Because they're not going to be that deep.
They're not going to be deep.
Seeds.
They're tiny seeds. So remember our 3X rule. We talked about it last week or last month. You're essentially planting them maybe anywhere from a quarter to a half an inch deep is the maximum. So they're up near the surface, and that will allow them to germinate quickly. the soils are warming up, and particularly like in my side yard where I have a south exposure up against a brick wall, I get a lot of reflected heat that is going to really push those vegetables along, yet the day temperatures are not going to be so terribly hot that other things start to happen. Mm. Now, with our onions, that's why we would suggest that you seed onions in March from seeds.
Outside.
Now, outside, yes. Now, if you want to grow transplants of yourself, we said last month you should have started your onion transplants, but we never recommend those going out into the vegetable garden until at least the middle of April. Now, the reason for that is that these plants already have several leaves on them when we put them out. If we put them out in March, the plant can receive sufficient cold temperatures yet, because our nights are still cold, that they will want to transition from vegetative growth, is what we really want. We want leaves and it eventually to produce a bulb. That growing point transitions too rapidly to a flower stalk, and then you don't get bulbing. All you do is you get flowers that are not of any use to you, because the cold is what stimulates that process, and we have sufficient cold that accumulates. And the timing of that is roughly 2 to 3 weeks of temperatures that average less than 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
Are they biennials?
Yes.
So they're just thinking, oh, I'm in my second year.
I think I'm in my second year. Okay. I'm getting the cold that I need. So our day temperatures up here in Logan over the weekend were about 55. In Salt Lake, they were about 60. But the night temperatures are down to 30. The average temperature is less than 50 degrees, and that's the trigger temperature. So we don't want to plant out transplants, and we certainly don't want to plant out sets until we're kind of above that 50-degree mark. And usually that occurs in northern Utah, kind of depending on where you are, but it occurs a little earlier, like in Salt Lake and in Provo and those areas, in Ogden. It might be we could start putting those transplants and sets out around the 10th of April. And maybe here in Logan, we might wait until in Brigham City, we might wait until the 20th of April.
So that's probably why when I used to plant sets a long time ago, and I quit doing it because I'd always get a little flower stalk and it just could never get big enough.
It kind of doesn't want to produce a bulb. Yeah. It tries to, but it can't. And I mean, you just look at it and you go, what is going on? Well, the plant only knows what it receives from the environment. It's cued into the sunlight. It's cued into the temperatures. And your job is to understand what triggers it, and what triggers it is cold, and the 50-degree mark is the key. Now, seeds, interestingly enough, I'll plant my seeds here in my commercial plantings with the farmers. They are germinating and growing, but they're not big enough to receive that signal. Your transplant and your set is big enough, and so we have to avoid that. So be smart about it, and don't do that, or you're going to run into some problems.
So let's back up. We've talked about this before, but I want to make sure that people understand what the difference is between a set and plant. And you go into the store and you see these bundled together,
yep.
But those aren't the same as when you're getting the ones that look like little bulbs already.
No, they are different. So the sets are plants that were planted out last year. Okay, they were grown for a while. They start to swell and produce a tiny bulb, and then they get dug up. And then they are stored for a period of time until they're distributed into the marketplace. Now, what they do is, because they've already had a bunch of growth that occurs with them, when you plant them, they grow really fast. They start to bulb a lot earlier, and those give us one of the characteristics that we like. We want to have some early onions, bulbing types. Now, they do produce a big bulb most years, if the conditions are right, but they tend to be a soft bulb. They aren't hard, and therefore they don't store nearly as well. So they tend to be kind of used or grown and then used immediately. And so in the home garden, you should think about them that way too. And that's why I've always told people, plant some seeds. Don't worry about planting them too thin or too thick. Just plant the seed out. It's hard to handle, but that's fine. Thin them as you go along, and then get to your final plant population, which would be about 2¾ to 3¼ inches apart, somewhere in there. So we would say 3 inches apart. And then that will produce a nice medium-sized onion bulb that you can use for all of your long-term storage stuff. But these sets are early, don't necessarily store as well, but sometimes they are the only ones that we can find in specific varieties that we may like. So if you really like some sweet-type onions, you might find Walla Walla sets. Or the second one is transplants, and essentially those are planted even later than the sets by commercial producers so that they aren't really bulbing yet, and you just get them as little plantlets, kind of like our transplants if you buy a tomato or a pepper transplant. That's really what they are. They come on a little bit later than the sets do in terms of their maturity. Oftentimes will bulb a little bit better and may actually store as well as seeds do, but that depends on a lot of things that happen over the course of the year, and we'll talk about onions a lot more as the year goes on as we meet monthly and have this discussion. So my recommendation is always plant some seeds. If you want really early onions, then maybe transplants or sets because they're always earlier. But don't rely on your transplants and sets to produce your best bulbs that would store for the longest period of time, because actually seeds actually do that.
Now, when you're planting from seed indoors and then setting them out,
then they're just like a transplant.
Then they're just like the transplant.
Exactly.
So will they still not store as well?
They can and they can't. The problem with it is that, you know, if the plant is a little bit on the big side, sometimes when you're buying transplants, you get these transplants that have, if you just peel them apart and look at all the layers, you may have 7 or 8 leaves already. Well, you have to remember that these things also are biennials. So if they've gotten some chilling, they may want to try and develop a flower, or they may actually develop the flower. And therefore, when they set up a bulb, they don't really set it up nearly as nicely as we would like it to be.
So bottom line is, plant from seed outside if you want good storage onions.
Yes, and that's, you know, commercially, that's what all the farmers do. And then you see those nice hard bulbs with a thin neck that, you know, put in your cold stored room that will stay until May or June of the next year. I always have onions that hang around until May or June. And by then, you're thinning out your seeded ones. So you got green onions. Some of those sets that are early maturing type will be starting to bulb so that you can be starting to harvest those in July. And you essentially have a full year of onions that you're eating out of your own garden. And that's not a hard thing to do if you follow the regime of some seeds and maybe some transplants and some sets, and not only just rely on transplants or sets.
So how do you know, generally are the red ones, they don't store as well as the yellows? I mean, now there are some yellows that are more, that are better than others. So how do you know what to look for? What are the indicators on either the packet or the variety that you're looking for that will help you know whether
usually
it's good storage?
Usually they will say, if you're buying onion seeds or something like that, they will talk about a sweet onion. So if it's a sweet type, it usually doesn't store as well. It doesn't have a deep dormancy. It'll start to sprout come late in early or mid-December and into January. You'll start seeing the green shoots pushing up out of it, because most of those shorter maturity types are sweeter onions and they're not really storage type onions. So you want to buy, most of what we grow here are Spanish types, so you want to look for the Spanish types, or maybe the hard long day types. They'll produce here as well. Reds usually don't store nearly as well as yellows do. Whites can or can't, depending on it. And it kind of depends on what your preferences are. We predominantly tend to use a lot of yellows, a few reds, probably no whites. So if you're thinking about, well, what do I use mostly, then you grow most of that. But maybe you want to try some of the other ones, because some of the reds can be sweet, but some of the reds can be pungent too. So it kind of just depends on what your preferences are. And then if you want sweet types, well, then, you know, you're going to have some Walla Wallas or something equivalent to that. Look for that on the package. And as it says, it'll say sweet, but it may say it's a storage type or a not. And usually, if it doesn't say it, it's a non-storage type. They will tell you that it's a storage type or not.
if I'm planting from seed outside, and weather conditions always make this, I want to make sure that I'm thinning them out soon enough, because one year I made the mistake of letting them stay in the ground too long, too close together, and I did not get much swelling at all.
That's right. And so, yeah, so you got
to... like they know they're close to another plant.
So usually we would, with onions, the last application of a fertilizer that we would put to kind of ensure that they grow normally and vigorously occurs somewhat time in early July. That would be our last application. But your thinning should have been done at least a month before that. Mm-hmm. So in May, you want to start thinning them. Finish up your thinning. So take some of them out. Use those for green onions. Finish up your thinning in June and into early July, so that your last thinning is also right around that time when you're going to put that next application of fertilizer on. And then what that last application of fertilizer, which would be the first 10 days or 2 weeks of July, you'd be finished with your thinning, which gives you the last of your green onions, unless you have a patch where you don't care. You might just leave a section of it because I like green onions and I don't want them to bulb so much. And so leaving them crowded actually restricts them from bulbing to a certain extent. And then in that storage section, that's what you would do there.
So I love using one of those older type salt shakers to put the seeds in the row, because it seems like every time I use my hands or try to sprinkle it with my fingers, I'm always getting a ton in one section and not enough in another.
Yeah, and that's the hard part with these. These seeds aren't uniform in shape. That's one thing about them. Plus, they're, as you get older, your fingers don't have the feel in them anymore to be able to, you know, kind of trickle them out, you know, in a way that gets them thin. So one of the new things that's coming out is that if you look in the seed catalogs or go online and look for seeds, you can find more and more seeds that have been pelletized. And essentially a pellet, what they do is they take a coating of a little bit of clay-like material, so it's usually clay or some inert material. They put a wetting agent in it so that it'll absorb water, and then they put a little bit of a plastic coating around it, and it makes it a nice, round, uniform shape. Hmm. And as a result of that, it's much larger in size, and it's easier for you as a gardener to handle. So a thing that gardeners that might want to try is to, instead of buying raw seed, buy pelleted seed. And try that on some of the ones that you think are a little bit harder to plant. Things like carrots sometimes could work really good for them. They're pelleting lettuce seed now because, you know, lettuce is like really flat. Mm. And when I try to do that, it's so fine. It's so hard to get it out. And it makes it a lot easier. Now you can space those seeds out a little bit. The other nice thing about them is they usually make them white, or they put a pink dye in them, or some kind of odd color that it stands out in the soil so you can actually see where they are, because lettuce seed is white most of the time, so that's pretty easy to see. But onion seed's black, spinach seed is kind of brown.
Get out the magnifying glass.
You have to really look hard for it. And the other nice thing about it is that it also will kind of give you some idea of how deep it is. And some of these seeds, when they're just in their raw state, you really are planting some deeper than other seeds, and you can really start to hone in on our 3X rule, where you're going to get them right at the right place so that a high proportion of them come up. And so, yeah, it's a little bit more expensive, but it certainly is a lot easier to handle. Now, the other thing is, if you're really into planting a lot of something and you have a little push planter or something like that, singulation is kind of critical, and it's easier to, you actually start using less seed. And so you don't have to buy 10 ounces of something. You might only have to buy 2 ounces of something, because the seed is pelleted or coated. And then when you disperse it with your planter, the planter actually helps you start to separate those seeds a little bit more effectively.
At the right depth
and all of the things that you want. And so particularly if you're running a big garden, you might want to consider purchasing some kind of planter unit that will do it. And that, believe me, these are planters that are being used in the home garden now are getting quite sophisticated, because they're taking technology that has been used in commercial operations and downsizing it And it really saves you a lot of time when you think about it, because you just get your ground prepped and zip it out there and plant, and you're done in like half the time.
Well, now, have you used them for the smaller seeds? Because I've got one, and I've used it for corn and beans and peas, and I absolutely love it, because it's just like zip, 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 I'm done planting.
Yeah.
But I've not tried it on the smaller ones.
We have used it. And one of the problems still is that, you know, sometimes you'll have to pick the right plate to go in the thing, so that particularly when you're using pelleted seed, it does a pretty good job of starting to separate things out a little bit more. And so, but there are a bunch of newer planters that are coming around. And if you start looking at seed catalogs and, you know, move beyond the seed section and into the, you know, the other section in the back of the catalog, usually this are, it's amazing the kinds of things that are coming out, and it won't be too many years and they'll have little, they're actually designing one now that has like a little vacuum pump on it. And what it does is it has a planter plate that has little tiny holes on it, and it creates a vacuum behind it so that the individual seed gets sucked up to a tiny hole and it holds it there. And then as it revolves around, as you're moving down the field or down the row, it gets to a point where the vacuum is broke, and that releases the seed and drops it in place. So it's beginning. They're getting to the point where with the little batteries that we have that are fairly powerful and a little suction motor on there, they're actually creating what we call precision seeders to go in your home garden. And they're really not that expensive. And if you think about that, then suddenly with onions or something like that, you no longer have to worry about how thick you're seeding. You could literally seed them to stand. So, you know, it's a really exciting time, because I'm seeing technology that has been used commercially now come into the home gardens, and it's going to make life in some ways a lot easier. Now, there are others that say, I really get a lot of enjoyment out of just doing some of those menial tasks of planting and hoeing and things like that, simply because my job is such that I need to decompress, so to speak. And my mind is taken up with this. And when I'm out there concentrating on seeds and concentrating on planting depths, I'm not thinking about my struggles of work or whatever. And it's kind of a zen-like moment, you might say, in the garden. And it really is, because, you know, it takes us back to our roots of, you know, hunter-gatherer, maybe.
Yeah, but there's this part of me that I'm thinking I'll actually plant more stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's a little easier to do it.
Yeah, and I think there's both sides to that. It kind of depends on who the individual is. And so it's really nice as we see these things coming forward. I'm excited about the future, because we're able to miniaturize things that now everyone gets the benefit of, rather than, oh, you know, it's, I remember as a kid, you know, we planted everything by hand, and we, other than corn and beans and stuff, where my dad got the corn planter out and we went into the garden with a corn planter. And you know, that just made those tasks a lot easier, but we planted an awful lot of beans and an awful lot of corn, as you can imagine. And so planting those by hand was not something, but when we had to do lettuce or when we had to do some of these other ones, it was like, oh my goodness. Father had his ideas about how it should be done, and we better have those same ideas when we did it.
I was looking in a catalog at new tools, and one of them is, it's like a fork, but it has 7 or 8 tines on it, and they're just close enough that you can get them in. I'm just for potatoes. I'm thinking in under the plant, pop everything out. Boy, that's going to make things so easy. He's like, okay, dear, can I spend $200 on this piece of equipment?
Well, you know, you have to convince her that I have a birthday coming up, and I have have Christmas coming up. So combine these things, or, you know, Father's Day and my birthday are, you know, reasonably close together. So, you know, just buy me this tool that's going to make my life in the garden easier. And
I'm grateful to my parents, because I was born right in March. So it's like, this is a perfect time.
Yeah, I know.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And we'll be back in just a bit. You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist here in studio. And we've recorded this a little bit earlier, so you won't be able to call in, but please do send your questions or comments, and you can do that via email at zestygarden@gmail.com or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and leave a question or comment there. So, Dan, one of the things I wanted to make sure that we talked about today is transplants.
Yeah.
And a lot of our listeners have probably already planted things indoors. How do you know how much fertilizer to give to those transplants?
Well, usually what we do is recommend that you buy some type of soluble fertilizer. That when you're planting the seeds, buying a soil mix or something like that, we mostly recommend that you don't buy a soil mix that has pre-levels of fertilizer in it.
Too much fertilizer?
Yeah, because it's often too much. The release pattern of that fertilizer is such that sometimes it interferes with the ability of the seed that we're planting in our potting soil to actually germinate. And that's due to a salt effect that injures the seed itself, or the root may be injured by the fertilizer that's in the media. So best to probably not fertilize it. But then as soon as you see that first leaf starting to form, so the seedling comes up, it produces seed leaves, or what we call the cotyledons. And then when you start seeing the first true leaf forming, that's when you need to start fertilizing the plant as well. Then the question is always, well, how much and how often? The best thing to do is to buy some soluble type fertilizer. And there are many different brands of those, but
ones that you can just mix in water.
You mix in water, and on the back of those packages, they always tell you how much. And usually it's put into, they'll have a little scoop or something like that in it, and they say mix one or two of these scoops per gallon of water, and that's the concentration that you want. Then you would feed it about once a week with that amount. And that's usually more than enough fertilizer to keep the plant growing healthy, being vigorous enough in growth, but not having so much excess fertilizer that sometimes the plant starts to get a little bit lanky or rank in its growth habit. You know, so it starts stretching out and producing kind of this thin, wimpy type of plant that we don't really want. We want a robust plant. So we don't want to really starve it, but we don't want to overfeed it either. If I eat too much, I get fat. If I don't eat enough, I lose weight. So, you know, you're trying to create that balance. And if you think about a plant, that's what we're trying to do. And oftentimes on the packages, it'll tell you the amount to put in a gallon of water and then kind of the frequency with which to do it. And they use information that they've gathered from university sources across the country. And so you can rely on that. And that's the best way to do it. And so once a week, and generally that once a week application would occur up until the point of the time that we're going to put it out into our vegetable garden. And then we might apply it once we put it into the vegetable garden. We're going to just apply that amount of fertilizer right in the planting hole with the crop so that there's some nutrients there that are readily available so that plant just wants to continue to grow just like it was when we were propagating it and plant in our homes or in our greenhouses or whatever, wherever we're growing these plants.
And so now this brings up one of your rules. How do you know when to transplant them or when it's too late to transplant them? What should you be looking for?
Yeah. The issue with transplanting is you want a plant that's big enough. So I usually say look for a plant, if you're going to buy one, that has 4 to 6 leaves on it, true leaves. And then you also want to pop that plant out of the container that it's being grown in.
So push up on the
bottom.
Yeah,
push up on
the
bottom or just grab it by the stem and it should pop out of there. And if it pops out and all the soil comes with it, and when you look at the root ball, where the if you see 50% soil and 50% roots, and usually on the outside of the container, the roots are growing around on the outside of the container, then that plant is ready to transplant. And so it may have 4 to 6 leaves on it. But if it's a cucumber or a squash, you might only have 2 leaves or 3 leaves on the plant when it reaches that point. So we call that, or I call that, my 50% rule. You see 50% roots around the outside of the root ball, and you see 50% soil. If it's less than that, usually what will happen is the soil will start try to break away from the root system. You know you have to grow it a little longer. And if you see mostly white roots and no soil, that means the plant's getting a little bit pot bound, and then you have to make a decision as to, do I do some root pruning? Do I cut the root system to break it up, to open it up so that it'll try to grow? And I usually don't recommend that we do that, because that just puts stress on the plant, and then the plant has to spend energy to regrow roots that you've damaged, and you've just spent 6 or 8 weeks growing a nice, high-quality, healthy, vigorous plant that wants to keep growing, and then you're just like cutting off my leg. You know, that's what I say to people. You know, just cut off my leg, because I don't need it. I can get around on one leg just fine. And that, we know that's not true. Well, for the plant, it's equally not true. It doesn't really like to have its roots damaged so severely. So the best thing to do is to grow them for the right length of time, grow them to the right size, and use that visual characteristic of the root system, 50% roots, 50% soil, when I pull it out of the container, and then it's going to be pretty much wanting to just go out in the garden and keep growing.
And you're going to want to make them a little more cold hardy as well. You don't want to just transplant them directly from your house to outside.
Well, there's interesting new research on that that suggests that conditioning, actually what we do, we call that conditioning or hardening the plant. And the thought always has been, well, we're prepping it to take the harsher environment out in the vegetable garden. There's some evidence that suggests that what often happens is we over-harden. So it gets exposed to too cold a conditions, and it stops its growth, and it's impacted by it. Or if we retract some water from it, then the plant is now under some stress in a different way. Or if we quit feeding it as much, it actually slows up its growth so much that it doesn't want to restart again. Or if we brush it too hard, you know, we've actually impacted it in some way. And so conditioning works, but oftentimes we don't know how or the treatment that we're doing. We don't understand enough about it, and we do more harm. Mm. What we say is we over condition the plants. So in effect, my advice is to put them out in the cold a little bit, but you know, you got to be careful of that, because today it might be 55 out and the plant might like it, but if we stick it out tomorrow and it's only 45, it might not like it. And so that impacts how that plant is responding. And I'm at work and it's cold out, and I should actually not have it outside, and so I'm over conditioning it by doing those types of things. So there are individuals that say, well, you don't really need to condition plants at all. You just take them out of the greenhouse. If you do, maybe cut back a little bit on the water a few days before it, so that you don't want them to wilt, of course, but you're just kind of watering them at maybe half the amount. Maybe instead of fertilizing them every week, the last week you cut back by 50% on the amount of fertilizer that they get. So if it said 2 ounces per 1 gallon of fertilizer, that's what your mix concentration should be. You maybe only go 1 ounce per 1 gallon, and that's your... So what you're doing is you're kind of putting a little bit of the brake on. It's kind of like going to the stop sign again. You know, we ease into the stop sign and we apply pressure. We just don't go up there and just slam on the brakes. We can do that. It's okay. We will stop, hopefully. But that's not how we want to treat the plants either. And so it's tricky to tell people how to condition, because most people don't understand what that means. And so maybe you don't need to at all. And there's some evidence that suggests that plants do just fine. Just take them out of the greenhouse and bang them out in the field, and they get growing just as good as any other type of plant.
So we have about 6 or 7 minutes left. I wanted to make sure I asked about digging any vegetables that are still in the garden. So I have carrots,
yep,
and some beets that are,
yep,
still in the garden. Hopefully the voles haven't helped themselves. I haven't seen as much vole damage this year. At what point, and it may already be transitioning, does the plant start prepping itself to grow again? So these carrots, for instance.
Well, you know, because they're what we call cool season vegetables anyway, they start to want to regrow as things start to warm up. And so I was noticing I have tulips that are just starting to push a little bit of leaf up. I have some of my daffodils that are doing that. I have some crocuses that are doing that. I mean, so if you start looking at other things in your garden, they're wanting to grow. Well, in many ways, these stored root vegetables like your beets, like your carrots, are also ones that start growing pretty at pretty cold temperatures. So, you know, as soon as you can, you should be really out there and trying to finish those things out. And the nice thing is they're pretty well chilled. They're fairly well hydrated. So dig them up, stick them in a plastic bag, and then they go into your chiller bin in your refrigerator, and they'll probably last for another month or two in there without any difficulty whatsoever.
So I've still got some snow in back there, and they're covered with the leaves. So there's so I
wouldn't
tidy, but it's that time of year where I know that within a week that snow's going to be
gone.
That
snow goes pretty fast, but as long as the soil is fairly saturated like it is, they're not going to be growing. The ground is pretty cold. That's why I always recommend a thermometer. Remember your garden thermometer. You can go out there and probe around and see what the temperature is at the root depth of those crops. So you would go down 2 or 3 inches and see if that temperature is right around 40 or 45, you're going to be okay to leave them out. But if that temperature starts getting above about 45, then they really want to start to grow again. And then they'll start putting out root hairs is the first thing that they do.
And then they don't taste as good.
And then they start using up sugars to grow root hairs, and that's why the flavor starts to change. And then you'll start seeing that growing point, the leaves that are there, you'll start looking inside and you'll start seeing new shoot growth. And in fact, what that shoot is the flower stalk that's being developed because they've received enough chilling at this point for these biennial vegetables to transition from vegetative growth to flower growth. And then all of the sugars are used to fuel the development of that flower stalk. And so that's why the flavor tends to go. So yeah, and watch them. You got a little while yet here in northern Utah, but you know, if you were down in southern Utah, you know, and you had them stored over winter, you better have had them out by now because they're really pushing growth hard.
But there's nothing better than a carrot left in the garden.
That's
it is
so good. That's right. So good. So the other thing that I thought we should talk about is what should we be thinking about transplants?
Yeah.
You know, so we talked about, you know, what to look for with a transplant, how to feed the transplant. But about start of March, between the 1st and the 15th of March, we also need to start thinking about starting our pepper seeds, starting our tomato seeds, some of those kinds of vegetables, which are warm season ones. Because if we think about it and we get them done by about the 15th of March, that means the 15th of April is 4 weeks. And it takes about 8 weeks to grow a pepper or tomato plant. So the 15th of March means the 15th of May, and that's about the time that we want to start setting things out in our vegetable garden, tomatoes, peppers, and some of those kinds of crops. So we really should be starting eggplant, peppers, tomatoes in particular at this time. If you're going to start trying to force some sweet potatoes because you want to try sweet potatoes, you want to do that now. That's another thing that you need to get started. You start growing those little slips, we call them, or those little shoots that we're going to plant out for sweet potato if we're trying that. Those are all things that need to be done now because we need 8 weeks to grow them. You should have already started your broccoli last month. Mm-hmm. You should have gotten your cabbage started because we're going to start planting those after 8 weeks as well. And that means that's going to be about the end of April that we're going to be putting those out into our vegetable garden, maybe even a little bit earlier than that. So, you know, those things should be well on their way. They should probably have a leaf or two already on them. You'll be feeding them, as we said, getting them moving. And then you're going to want to wait with things like cucumbers if you're going to grow cucumbers from transplants or your melons or something like that, because they take about 4 or 5 weeks to grow. And so we want to kind of make sure that we have enough time for them, but we don't want to start them so early that we get this really, really big plant that doesn't really like to get moved so much. So normally we would tell people, don't start your watermelons, don't start your cucumbers until around the 15th. So tax time is a good time to think about that. Okay, I got to have my taxes done, but I got to have my cucumbers planted about the same date. And then they'll be ready, you know, sometime about the middle of May or toward the end part of May so that they're into the warmer weather conditions that are there. The caveat always is if you like to put low tunnels or if you like to use hot caps or wall of waters, those give you 10 days or 2 weeks of earliness. So you can plant into those. You need to have a little, you know, you might have needed to start a little bit earlier depending on if you do those things to try and catch your early production.
So you talking about that reminds me another of one of your rules if you're putting something under a hot cap,
yep,
the air temperature outside is 30 degrees less than the temperature on the inside.
That's correct.
I'm remembering that correctly.
So now there are not a lot of things that we're going to throw covers over, but what I do in my side beds is it gets a little warm, so I always make a little bit of a plastic cover over top of them because I actually want to try and stimulate them a little bit. I might put some fleecy row cover over top of them, all of those things to trap more heat during the day because, you know, it's a side yard. The wind swirls around the back of the house. Some days that wind isn't as warm as I would like it to be. So having no wind means I have a still air zone and still air heats up when heat's reflecting off the sidewall or heat's coming off of the soil, so I can trap that heat around the plant. And that's what a row cover or a low tunnel or a hot cap or a wall of water does. It's designed to just create a nicer environment for it. But at the other end, the temperature rule is all about making sure that we're not overheating them as well, because you can cook the plants as quickly as you can you know, get them to grow faster. And so that's what we're really thinking about. So, yeah, get your plants started. You know, tomato time, it's tomatoes, peppers, you know, eggplants and all of those ones that take a little bit longer to grow. Wait another month before you start planting your melons and some of those kinds of crops, because we really only want two leaves about on those when we transplant them out. They grow a lot faster. Big plants on the cucurbits is not good. They don't like it. And we'll talk about that next month again when we come back in early April.
Okay, Dan, thank you very much.
Well, it's always good to come, and happy gardening, everybody.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist and joins Zesty Garden every first Thursday of the month, so we'll have him back in April. Coming up next is Petals and Prose.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. Lately, I've been seeing hyacinths in the flower section of the grocery stores. Not yet in my garden, but it won't be long. And I remembered a favorite essay that I bring out every time a hyacinth appears in my life, and I'd like to read that to you. It's called Hyacinths to Feed the Soul, condensed from a St. Joseph magazine and by Carol Ummon. When I was a student nurse, I babysat during off-duty hours to help pay my way. One day I got a call to sit for a whole weekend. All I knew when I headed for the job was that the couple wanted to get away from their two kids for a few days. Expecting that only rich people would be able to do that, I was surprised when the address turned out to be a tiny house in the borderline part of the city. Ted, the husband, had just joined an architectural firm. His wife, Ardith, looked terribly tired. They waited, obviously anxious to be off, while I got acquainted with the children, 2.5 years and 11 months old. I held the baby against my shoulder while Ted gave me the name of their hotel. "You'll be there the whole time?" I asked. "Well, that's headquarters," Ted answered. "We'll sleep late, prowl around town, eat when we get hungry, visit the art galleries." Mentally, I added up the cost of all this, plus my fee. "But won't that be terribly expensive?" I blurted. I had adopted them already. "Why, yes, I guess it will," Ted said, "but it's important." We're both tired and snapping at each other. Ardith especially needed to get away from the children. Ardith smiled at me. "Don't you know Gilistan by Musil Uddin Sadi, a sheik who lived more than 700 years ago? If of thy mortal goods thou art bereft, and from thy slender store 2 loaves alone to thee are left, sell one, and with the dole buy hyacinths to feed thy soul." That poem taught me a good deal. These two didn't even have enough money for the trip, but they were tuned into a set of values I'd never even thought of. Sunday night, when they came back, they looked like teenagers who'd just discovered love, and my money was tucked under the ribbon on a pot holding a lavender hyacinth. Over the years, I've made a hobby of noticing people and whether or not they know about using non-essentials and extravagances occasionally to feed the soul. they're the happiest people. A church organist I know grew up in a family during the Depression. They didn't starve, but her childhood was not happy. Then, when I was in the seventh grade, things changed, she told me. My folks bought a secondhand piano and arranged with a music teacher in town to accept vegetables in payment for my lessons. The neighbors called it a useless extravagance. The miracle is that my folks knew what was important. 20 cashmere sweaters couldn't have charged me with the confidence that piano gave me. A no-nonsense mother I know lets Christmas and family birthdays release her usual tight lid on frivolity. When I was a child, she explains, gifts were always dirty shoes, warm gloves, underwear. After I got married, I decided that we'd somehow manage the essentials, that the special occasions would be for fun. Now my husband and I give a play a white velvet coat she's worn twice and has had cleaned twice, but which makes her feel positively elegant. For the children, redeemable coupons for gooey treats at the ice cream store. Flowers given on birthdays or other predictable occasions are hardly hyacinths, but when bouquets are offered to celebrate Monday, or the anniversary of the day we got the car paid for, or simply as thank you for putting up with me for so long, well, that's a different matter. To send a relative a card on his birthday is not unusual, but to pop a note into the mail apropos of nothing is a hyacinth. The mother who spells I love you with chocolate chips on top of a no occasion cake is proclaiming loud and clear that she cares. When our stomachs are empty, we get hungry. Symptoms of soul starvation are subtler. Tomorrows and tomorrows are rolling by. Paychecks are being spent on bread and shoes and rent, while the walls of our souls remain bare. If this matters to us, we can do something. We can buy hyacinths to feed the soul. That's the end of the essay. But I remember a poem by Elizabeth Barrett Browning that is saying a similar thing. Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit round it and pluck blackberries. Also, I very much like Annie Dillard's book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, and she, again, seems to be addressing the same thing. When I was 6 or 7 years old, growing up in Pittsburgh, I used to take a precious penny of my own and hide it for someone else to find. It was a curious compulsion I had. Sadly, I've never been seized by it since. For some reason, I always hid the penny along the same stretch of sidewalk up the street. I would cradle it at the roots of a sycamore, say, or in a hole left by a chipped-off piece of sidewalk. Then I would take a piece of chalk and, starting at either end of the block, draw huge arrows leading up to the penny from both directions. After I learned to write, I labeled the arrows, "Surprise ahead," or "Money this way." And I was greatly excited during all this arrow drawing and the thought of the first lucky passerby who would receive in this way, regardless of merit, a free gift from the universe. But I never lurked about. I would go straight home and not give the matter another thought until some months later I would be gripped again by the impulse to hide another penny. When I was teaching, I had read my class this passage, and at the end of class, I threw out 100 or a couple of hundred pennies and excused the class and waited to see who would bother and who would take the time to pick up the pennies. As it turned out, I picked up most of the pennies because no one else did. Anyway, I hope that you will, so to say, pick up the pennies that are liberally strewn about us if we will take time to see. Again, this is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
And now in our gardening calendar, we have quite a few items. A plant propagation workshop from Cache County Extension is next Thursday, March 10th from 6 to 9 p.m. and Saturday, March 12th from 9 a.m. to noon at the USU Teaching Greenhouse, 1390 North 800 East in North Logan. You'll receive native and water-wise plants for your own yard. The cost is $30 and includes an online workbook, seeds, and planting materials. Participants will take home 60 planted seeds. Registration is required at 752-6263. Joab County Extension in Nephi offers her class next Thursday evening, March 10th, from 7 to 8 p.m. on water-wise plants and easy landscaping. Participants will learn how to conserve water by using plants with low water requirements. Low-maintenance landscaping will also be taught. The class is at the Joab County Center Cultural Hall, 160 North Main in Nephi. Registration is free and is at 435-623-3450. And help the Moab Charter School do a spring tidy-up of their bee-inspired garden. Volunteers will spread mulch, prune plants, and more. Bring your garden gloves, pruning tools, and shade hat. A snack will be provided. The event is Friday, March 11th from 2 to 5 p.m. The Pollinator Garden is at 358 East 300 South in Moab. No registration is required. Just show up. On Saturday, March 12th, is a fruit tree pruning demonstration at the USU Botanical Center in Kaysville. USU Extension experts will show you the art and science of proper pruning practices so you'll be ready to prune your fruit trees, raspberries, blackberries, and grapes with confidence. Dress for the outdoor conditions. Registration is for free. For a chance to win a free set of pruners at usubotanicalcenter.org. And on Saturday, March 19th, the City of St. George is hosting the Spring into Veggie Gardening class at 10 a.m. at the Tahnequint Nature Center. You'll receive tips on planting and growing spring vegetables in southern Utah. The class is free, but reservations are required by calling the Washington County Water Conservation District at 435-673-3671. If you have an item for the Zesty Garden calendar, whatever or wherever you listen to us, let us know about it by sending it to zestygarden@gmail.com. Thanks for listening today. The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.